I'm Joan Stevenson, editor of JAMA's Medical News and Perspectives section. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. John Williams about depression, a major cause of disability worldwide. Dr. Williams, why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners?
I'm John Williams. I'm a professor of medicine and psychiatry at Duke University Medical Center and the Center for Health Services Research and Primary Care at the Durham VA.
Dr. Williams, what do we know about the prevalence of depression, and are there important demographic characteristics?
In adults that we see in primary care, the prevalence of major depressive disorder is about 6%. Dysthymia, which is a milder but more chronic illness, affects another 2 to 3%. The two depressive disorders have a combined prevalence of about 8 to 9% and are the conditions for which we have good trial data showing that treatment works. Therefore, they are the key conditions to detect. Said another way, on average, one out of every 9 to 11 patients will have a treatable depressive disorder, or for most primary care clinicians, they'll see about 2 patients a day with a depressive disorder. The most important risk factors are female gender. Women are about 1.5 to 2 times more likely to have a depressive disorder than men, and also chronic diseases such as cardiac disease or chronic pain increase the prevalence of depression. There's also some association with age, with a peak incidence in mid-adult life about the time parents are raising teenage children.
I wonder if that's a coincidence.
Probably not.
Which symptoms increase the probability that a patient is experiencing depression?
Depression is a symptom-driven diagnosis. There's no lab test or imaging study to confirm the diagnosis. So clearly, any of the DSM or Diagnostic and Statistical Manual symptoms of depression, such as sleep disturbance, low energy, increase the probability. There's also been a lot of research about so-called somatic presentations of depression. That is, physical symptoms such as pain or headache that some have labeled as red flags for depression. These symptoms, like pain, particularly when medically unexplained after a basic evaluation, greatly increase the probability of depression.
Which history and physical examination findings are helpful when detecting depression, and which findings are not helpful?
The most important symptoms, of course, are the DSM criteria, and a common mnemonic for that is SICKY-CAPS, which stands for sadness, decreased interest, guilt, low energy, difficulty with concentration, a change in appetite, psychomotor retardation, and sleep disturbance or suicidal ideation. In terms of history, other things that are useful include an open-ended question that some of us call the HATA question, which stands for how are things at home? And the goal of that is that we're hoping to get at underlying life stressors. In addition, a family history or personal history of depression is important. Over 50% of people with a first depressive episode will go on to have at least one subsequent episode. It's also important to ask about the effects of the depressive symptoms on the individual's ability to carry out usual activities at home or at the workplace, or effects on interpersonal relationships. And that's because to diagnose clinical depression, there must be some impairment in functioning. In terms of physical exam, probably the most important physical exam finding is simply how the patient looks. Do they have a depressed affect? Beyond that global impression, symptoms or physical exam findings that might suggest an underlying medical condition such as hypothyroidism, underlying malignancy, or an autoimmune disorder should lead the clinician to evaluate the patient for these possibilities as a potential alternative diagnosis.
There are a number of different depression screening instruments, as mentioned in your chapter on depression and the rational clinical examination. What might be useful for our listeners to know about these instruments?
Yes, there are literally a whole host of screening instruments that have been tested in primary care settings. The last time I counted, there were 15 different scales, and the number seems to grow every year. With the exception of the geriatric depression scale, which is designed specifically for older adults, all the remaining instruments were designed for general adult populations. They range from a single item that asks only about depressed mood up to 30 item instruments. Most of the instruments use one of two response formats, either a simple yes-no or a frequency rating. So, for example, the number of days in the past 2 weeks that the individual experienced a particular symptom. Although the number of items and the scoring approach varies, they're all easy to complete. They take anywhere from less than a minute to no more than 5 minutes. And the scoring approaches are generally simple. Once you get experienced with them, they take under 5 seconds to do the scoring. So in terms of general characteristics, the take-home message is that there are a lot of choices, but that all the different instruments are easy to use. Now, for the important question of how they perform, there's some variability there, and there are several issues to consider. First, how well do they perform in identifying depressed patients? Also, can they be used to measure the severity of illness, and can they be used to measure response to treatment? So, like a blood pressure cuff for hypertension, we want the instrument for depression to be useful not only for diagnosis, but to assess severity and response to treatment. In terms of identifying depression, I am a very pragmatic and time-constrained clinician, so when we analyzed these instruments, I was really hoping the single-item scales would work. But in fact, they perform worse than the longer scales. However, the good news is that the longest scales, such as the 30-item geriatric depression scale, don't perform any better than the relatively brief scales of 10 items or less. Now, among those brief scales, the patient health questionnaire is one of particular merit. It's a 9-item scale. It can be scored from 0 to 27, and it maps directly to the DSM criteria and performs the best of the various instruments. So, for example, a depressed patient is about 5 to 7 times more likely to score 10 or higher on the PHQ-9, 10 being the threshold for a positive screen, than a non-depressed patient. This translates to a sensitivity of about 80%, so you pick up about 8 out of 10 depressed patients, and a specificity of 95%, meaning that there are relatively few false positives. Finally, although I suspect that many of the instruments could be useful for monitoring treatment to response or response to treatment, the PHQ-9 is also the only instrument that's been formally tested and shown to be responsive to change over time in primary care patients.
What are the reference standard tests for depression?
So that's relatively straightforward. The reference standard is a clinical interview conducted by someone who's trained to establish the DSM-4 criteria. There have been a number of studies testing the inter-rater reliability, so asking the question, can two interviewers agree on the diagnosis? And those studies have shown very high agreement.
Is there anything else that JAMA evidence users should know about the bedside diagnosis of depression?
Yes, I'd say two things. We know that relying exclusively on clinical intuition or how a patient looks leads to many missed cases. So if you want to do a good job of detecting depression, you need to institute screening, and this can be done effectively with instruments as short as 2 items, or alternatively, keep a high index of suspicion and ask about depressed mood or anhedonia in anyone who presents with a red flag symptom such as pain or a DSM symptom such as insomnia. The second point is that a diagnosis of depression needs to be made based on a very careful evaluation. Administering an instrument like the PHQ-9 or going through the DSM-4 criteria coupled with an appropriate physical examination and any needed laboratory testing. When this is not done in primary care settings, it may lead to unnecessary treatments for patients who have subsyndromal depression or who are simply having a bad week and won't benefit from treatment. So the bottom line is screen or have a high index of suspicion to detect unrecognized cases of depression, then do a careful evaluation to confirm that the patient has a depressive disorder that will likely benefit from treatment.
Thank you, Dr. Williams, for this overview of depression. For additional information about this topic, JAMA Evidence subscribers can consult the online chapter on depression in the Rational Clinical Examination, which includes updated material, an education guide on this topic, and other features. This has been Joan Stevenson of JAMA interviewing Dr. John Williams about depression for JAMA Evidence.